It's Darren Winston's book report.
Hey, Jill.
All right, tell me a story. And start it with Once Upon a Time.
Once Upon a Time, I bought a box of books. And I want to say it was about 8 or 9 years ago. It was a while ago. And without checking my notes, I can't remember where from. There was nothing extraordinary about the purchase. I just bought a box of books. And in there was this funny little book about the financial world, published in about 1920. And it was interesting. You know, I like that sort of thing, and I've got customers who do. But I couldn't find out anything about it. I couldn't find any auction records. I couldn't find any copies for sale online. I couldn't find anything about it. So I just put it back on a shelf, and I thought I'll look at it another day. And a while later, maybe a year later, I looked again, couldn't find anything except a paperback from the 60s when it had been reprinted. I thought, oh, that's cool, I'll get that. And I ordered it for whatever, $5 or $10. Didn't get me any closer to knowing what I had, but I now knew that I had this book that someone somewhere was amused enough to republish it like 46 years later. So I put both of them back on the shelf for a few years.
They propagate.
Exactly. And, you know, again, a few years later, took them down, couldn't find out anything. And I mean, I looked every corner of the book world and the internet that I could, put them back on the shelf. And then recently, a couple months ago, I pulled both of them down and I thought, okay, I gotta get to the bottom of this. And with the help of my crack assistant, we were able to deduce a few things. First of all, that it was reprinted again 3 years ago. So we go from about 1920 to 1966 to 2013.
Do we have them pre-crash or post-financial?
So the first one was pre-crash. It was 20 with the crash in 29. And then the 66 and the 2013, I don't know what was happening in the mid-60s, but the 2013 was clearly after 2008. And all the other years in between.
Yeah.
We got to work, and what was most intriguing was the book was published with a pseudonym, which didn't help us at all. The two people that reprinted it had no idea who wrote it originally. There wasn't even speculation. It was just the information went with the original publisher, and the original publisher went out of business 18 years ago. So what we were able to figure out was that one copy had appeared in the marketplace and had been sold, and the bookseller had no more information. But at least we can prove that there was a second one out there.
The second one of the first one?
Exactly, a second copy of that first edition from 1920. So now it was to deconstruct the inscription, because the inscription was worded in such a way that it was by the author, whoever that was. So, and this I have to give
and
all
how could you could just simply tell you to my
yeah, it said something like it was inscribed to somebody, and it said something like to my friend the counselor, who had he counseled me wisely would have told me not to write this book. So that was pretty much a smoking gun, and those were most of the words that were used. So
because way back when you used to inscribe something, the author.
Right, exactly. You would often say, you know, with the compliments of the author, and that was also that allowed someone apart from the author to write that. So you might have Mark Twain saying, send this book to Mrs. McGillicuddy, and then his assistant, secretary, whatever, would say with the author's compliments. So now...
Have you noticed that Mrs. McGillicuddy
comes up
a lot?
Yes. And I can tell you, if you haven't figured it out, it all comes from I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
I thought, what a great
And that's always
maiden name.
Yeah.
So let me see if I can get back on that wagon.
You
that
found
digression.
You found the second copy of the
right. Oh, actually, no. I wanted to finish the thought about the with the author's compliments.
Okay.
So people like Mark Twain that are hugely
collected,
but also tons and tons of research on his books and his handwriting and everything. We can deduce which point he wrote from the author and when it was perhaps a certain secretary. And the same goes for certain presidents who, with tons of correspondence, you know, it might have been Missy LeHand that signed something or wrote something, not necessarily signed it.
In many cases, you can, and this is, I hope that most people know this. I'm going to continue. there are many people responsible for the correspondence.
Oh, exactly.
In lots of big corporations still to this day, not every, you know, Fortune 100 even CEO is sitting there answering his emails.
Right. So in the case of there's a term in the book trade, you know, signed by so and so in a secretarial hand, which covers a lot of sins, but it means not by the original person. So back to the book we're talking about. It was signed by someone, just didn't know who it was. So when Crack Assistant got to work, was able to deduce by way of who the publisher was, who the people could have been. And then at some point, I remember we were looking at the computer together, and I said, why don't we type in these couple of names? And some 19-teens document comes up. Actually, it was a court document. And this name jumped out at me, and I looked at the book, and I thought, that's the guy. And, you know, when you look at a name that you can't make it out, and it could say Lucille McGillicuddy, or it could say, like, Herman Hagedorn, and you don't know because you don't know how that person forms their letters, the minute you see what the name is, you go back, and it's like, of course that's what it says. Right. So anyway, big celebration.
But which is the fun part of doing this.
Oh, completely.
For anyone who has the remotest CSI, you know, crime pulling, let's go a little bit further, let's figure out who wrote this, it can be done.
Oh,
it's just so
totally
fulfilling.
Rewarding.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it's not a $1 million book.
Doesn't matter.
But so we figure out who it is, we then figure out who the person it was inscribed to was, because we can now put the two people in the same world at the same time. It makes sense why he's referring to his friend as giving him counsel. And then there turns out to be this fantastic story about the publisher of the book, who also published a financial magazine, who was sued around the time of the First World War because the magazine and the publisher were accused of a sort of a blackmail, where the people who brought suit said they could only get editorial space if they they could only get favorable editorial space if they advertised, and that sort of thing. I mean, it's a variation on payola, like you pay to play. So in this case, the publisher won the publisher lost the suit, but stayed in business for 70 years, which is fascinating. So anyway, I'm done with all of this, and I can't tell anybody, because now a big part of the value of the book is I've got the key to the mystery. So I called a colleague of mine a couple days ago in London, and I said, I have this book. I know you'll love it. It's got you written all over it. This is the price. And I said, I can send you the description we've done, the sort of single page, but it's going to be completely redacted because I can't tell you any of these names, because that's a part of its value, but it's also a part of, if I tell everyone, like, the cat's out of the bag. And we had this big laugh, and he loved the idea of it and said, yes, I'll take it. I know, you know, I have a customer for it. So I then jokingly said, okay, I'll send you the unredacted one with all the names exposed. And there it was. But to think that it was just sitting on a shelf percolating, not only for 8, 9, or 10 years, but I think at one point I probably had it when I lived in the city. And then it moved to maybe a storage unit. And then it moved to my house in the country. Then it moved to my shop. Then it moved to the office in the shop. But it's now, I just packed it up. It's on a plane on its way to another country with its identity revealed. And it's great fun. As you said, it's a huge part of why we do this, because it's not even a victory. It's just a great little episode that makes all the ones that don't pan out worth it, because you think, yeah, that's why the digging was worth it.
And it's also truly important at a time like this, where there's so much surface, you know, don't even bother with context. Give me your three words of what you saw, and that becomes the truth.
Right.
And no one is bothering to
show the work.
And no one is bothering, because who has time for that? And the fact is that unless you see it, not just a picture of it, you can't really, the picture of it, if we just even used your book, wouldn't have, you might have said inscribed, but it wouldn't have sent you on the same quest.
No, exactly.
As this 11 years, 12 years of percolating cooking time before it was ready to reveal itself.
Right.
And that's just, it reminds me of the tale of the telltale heart. Edgar Allan, it's like, it was the beating of the telltale heart. Just, it's there. You just have to keep looking and looking and looking. So does the person who has it now, is his client collected that sort of, was it more that his client collected financial things?
Yeah, exactly. It was financial things. And what was kind of amusing, in both of the reprints, the author referred to how the identity had eluded them and eluded everyone else, and the person who published it a few years ago. And both of those publishers were basically men who published them on their own with their own sort of, now we just call it self-published and variation on that, both in the financial world. So they sort of, it's full of inside jokes and inside references. And it was very amusing that with these, I guess, two sort of 40 plus year gaps, they were able to keep the books relevant. They were completely relevant to the same industry in the same way, with a little bit of updating in the same way that they updated the Hardy Boys stories from the 1920s and 30s, where you can't talk about using a crystal set or lighting up a smoke or whatever when you're a 14-year-old boy. And in the case of the 2013 one, and I was looking at it just recently, they have reprinted the letters, they've updated them. Some of them are completely new, and I guess they deal with more relevant things, but I just think it was fun, it is fun, and to your point about not being able to do it from a photo, so much comes from the way it feels in your hand, the weight of it. Like often somebody will come to the shop and they'll say, oh, I have a first edition of To Kill a Mockingbird, that however they got it, can you have a look at it? And they'll hand it to me, and I could tell them with my eyes closed that this particular book couldn't possibly be the first edition because it doesn't weigh enough. The paper stock, and because some of the book clubs and some of the reprint houses used a poorer quality paper stock, poorer quality boards to make the covers, and the book just comes out lighter. So again, to your point about the photo, you just need to touch it, or you need to see. I remember going early on in my career, going to somebody's home, and they had tons and tons of books, and they were all the same height, and I thought, that's
how amazing.
Yes, exactly.
Library.
How does that work? And it turned out that they were members of a certain book club, and that book club issued everything in the same size, which is not unheard of by any stretch, but it was maybe 90% of their collection. So as I was going through and seeing great titles, I was sort of saddened that there was no point in pulling them out because they were all bought, you know, over a certain period of time, maybe 50 years ago, but still where they were just the inexpensive alternative at the time. Not only didn't grow in value, but sort of lost value because, as we've discussed, book club editions have that sort of scarlet letter of the book world, and nobody wants them, sadly.
Maybe we can change that. It's Darren Winston's Book Report.
Thanks, Jill.